What about their TV habits? As compared with yours. Now, the base, the norm is you. They represent departures from the norm, you. You use yourself as a norm, as a fixed pattern, the right way to do things. And then you just notice the ways in which your 12, 11, 9, 10, so on, year old brothers and sisters depart from this norm. Well, you are in a kind of inarticulate position, that's all. He says, what about if you have no younger brothers and sisters? Well, there's obviously nothing to say. Need I say more?
You can go to the rent a little brother agency and
yeah,
pick one
what
up.
About, you know, hire an orphan? But I don't want essays on this subject. I just want a few words to indicate complete departure of pattern, change. There's another item here I see to remind you of. On April 14, there'll be an exam on understanding media in March, this room.
March 14.
I'm sorry.
March 14.
March 14. March 14, an exam in this room on understanding media.
I have a slogan about the song. I think different ways people approach songs.
I think people used to sing songs, and I think the younger generation becomes a song. And I think we could say today, as a slogan, be a song and feat, F-E-A-T, man. Become a song, meaning show how you feel. And you will feat, you will get things done, move things, turn people on, and man makes it a cool medium.
Well, thanks, Father. You can see that what he's getting at is that the old idea of song and dance was spectator. And Father's suggesting the new mode of song and dance is total participation. Anyway, you can do, I'm sure that if you do this job with a little care, you don't have to do it all in 1 hour or 1 day. Just make notes from day to day. And,
One thing would be useful there is attention to that near point reading thing. Whether it's observable compared to yourselves or to whether the younger children, especially if they're running around the neighborhood, they are to the page.
What is called near point is a technical term in oculist circles. How close does a child tend to get to the page when he's reading and writing? Now, the officially therapeutic distance is supposed to be about 18 inches. Arm's length, as it were. Or this forearm's length. In ordinary classrooms today, the distance is much closer. Since TV, the child has tended to close in on the page a great deal. This tends to create all sorts of distortion and learning difficulties.
Yeah.
Very good question. What would you say as an answer? Look, there, you're talking about one of the main difficulties the Negro has. You can relax now. A Negro feels a tremendous need to westernize or acquire print orientation so that he can compete. Exactly to the degree to which he does this, he betrays the values of his people. He goes over to the white man. This is one of the great dilemmas of the Negro question. Whether to centralize, integrate, merge with the white culture, or to separate and set up his own culture. Now, this is an extremely complicated question because Negro music and dancing and song have had a profound effect on the white man for the last 80 years. Electric technology is against integration in the question of all races. Electric technology favors separatism and unique cultural form for each people. I'm coming at it indirectly. All of us are caught in the electric age between cultures. We have a huge backlog in literacy dating 2,500 years. All our new technology is undermining literacy. Our educational establishment is caught on that hook, totally. The Vietnam War is merely one little footnote in that problem. Whether to westernize Vietnam by enforcing a Western blueprint upon their society, or to allow them to develop using the latest technology. Pentagon has no answer to this question, hasn't a clue any more than it has to the Negro question. I suggest the best way to get at these problems is to understand the nature of the problem before you make any plans. In this class, we're dedicated to using multimedia and the examination, you will find, will not violate this principle at all. But anyway, it is a dilemma in which I am caught as much as, more than you, because my involvement in the print world is enormously greater than yours, because it's 30 years longer at least. Yes, and decentralism in all forms, just like the telephone. You see, there's no need to go to work in the telephone age. Commuting, going down to some central place so that you can phone people, is sheer nonsense. But it's typical of the dilemma in which our world exists. There is no reason, there is hardly any businessman in New York who has any need to go downtown to work. There's almost no reason for doing so except habit. Yes, up in Toronto, we've done several studies on this, and that's why we want you to contribute your observations.
But at the same time, this decentralizing thing is absolutely so. How about the other element of the connectedness that it sets up, the global village dimension?
The global village is not connected. It is a space. It's like a pun. It's all the cultures at once, all making themselves heard at once. You have a nice example with the Beatles. They have recently announced that they can no longer put on stage shows. Their new technologies of song making and entertainment making require so many media, including crowd noises, that they said they are never going to put on another stage show. A stage is a picture frame, visual space arrangement in which they can no longer operate. So they've abandoned visual space in favor of auditory space, the recording, the sound studio. And they're not going to make any more appearances live again. This is a dilemma, though, because they've, in order to make this step, they've had to sacrifice a great deal of money. I wanted to make one comment on your very nice essays on meaning. If there is an answer to that question, what is the meaning of meaning, it's quite simply experience or involvement. But that means that in order to experience anything, you have to relate it to something. Meaning is a relationship. It's not just an input, or like some classified meaning out of a dictionary. It means having some idea of how that word works in an actual situation. You relate it to other things than just its own isolated, classified meaning. You hear it, you feel it, you live it, you experience it. Experience is a relationship. It is not an isolated event. So the meaning of meaning is just simply involvement, is relating things to things and not just classifying isolated meaning such as you get in a dictionary. Many of you got that. A very large proportion of your answers were in favor of the dictionary classified meaning as meaning. But most of you, I think, settled for the idea of experience as the meaning of meaning. But the mere fact that people in this age ask what is the meaning of meaning indicates that we're living in a very strange time indeed. Well, now, we have some very interesting pictures for you today, and I think I've taken up more than enough time. Our first slot.
Harley, you want to play this? I need some lights up.
Line muted.
You see all right with the lights on?
I'm just testing something. I just want to check something. I'm going to take it back.
Line
this is a
unmuted.
Piece of high relief sculpture.
It's 10 to 12. Harley, you want to? Yeah, I need some lights out there.
No,
that's okay. You see all right with the lights on? All right.
Jim, can you knock a couple off maybe at the front?
This is a piece of high relief sculpture from an area which was initially called Gandhara. It's now in Pakistan. It's interesting because the native Pakistani concept of sculpture, which is very close to the Indian, has been married to a Roman concept of storytelling. It's probably Greek or Roman. So that while it retains much of the flowing line of the Indian sculpture, which was of necessity very flat when they dealt in the frieze idea, you'll notice that they begin to deal in individualized portraiture, which is totally alien to the Gandharans. They have, at this stage, as a matter of fact, they have Buddhas, or bodhisattvas, which have the Apollonian head. Very famous Greek concept of Greek beauty in the head. I don't have a slide of it, but it's an interesting thing to point out that they married one to the other. So we're involved in two kinds of spaces here, really. The narrative element and the psychological portraiture, which begins to show here, is very definitely the visual pictorial bias.
The other elements in the sculpture come directly out of the iconic.
Well, sculpture itself is iconic. Suppose a poet were only allowed the medium of stone in which to write poetry. That he could only write his poems by chiseling them into granite. It would change his concept of poetry very fast.
Sure, poetry would become very aphoristic, very terse, very tight, in order to eliminate as much carving in the rock as possible.
Headlines tend to be a little bit on that pattern of iconic, sculptured images, and they have to be very terse. No storyline.
I'd like to get them. Are there any questions? I'd like to get you involved in this a little bit. Are there any questions about this kind of concept of bringing two types of spaces together, and what is the response to it as a mode of art? Do you find it extremely alien, for instance, as you would generally traditional Pakistani art?
Perhaps the historical factor here should help. When Rome and Greece entered the Orient, when Alexander the Great plunged into the Oriental world, he brought completely new forms of perception to the East. And Rome did likewise, somewhat like England in India. The one culture was imposed on top of another culture. What you have here are two cultures, two spaces, imposed one over the other. And this is happening in your present world on a vast scale.
Historically, there's another very good example of it, would be the so-called Elgin marbles in the British Museum. They are the friezes taken from the Parthenon. Now, generally speaking, I know that my own relationship to art history and the study of it, I was quite shocked when I saw these figures because they are extremely iconic, almost cartoonish. And the whole quality of what we think of as intense Greek realism actually came later than the Elgin marbles, the frieze of the Parthenon. Very primitive figures indeed.
You have, curiously and without premeditation on our part, on the extreme right and the extreme left of this room, two Chinese paintings, one of them Western and one of them Eastern. On your right, the figure over there is sitting almost in a perspective of visual space. The figure is very iconic, but the space is very pictorial and visual and continuous with a receding or vanishing point.
Notice the foreshortening, for instance, in the lamb.
But on your left is a Chinese painting which is flat, without perspective. That's real Oriental. I don't know who selected these. I have no idea how long they've been here. But they're contrasting modes of space. This one being sculptural, flat. This one being pictorial, receding, vanishing point.
Actually, this goes way past just the factors of realism. The diagonal, which runs through this way and cuts that way, is actually a Baroque tradition, a method of cutting space of the 17th century.
In other words, though, this one on the right is the result of Western influence and intrusion into the Orient.
And it's notable, too, that the quality of the drawing, because of this fusion, it hasn't been completely brought together in the artist's mind, so that the drawing is bad Western drawing and bad Chinese drawing, because he hasn't managed to make that marriage between the two. As over here, the drawing is excellent in the Chinese tradition.
What we call rationality is pictorial space, connected, continuous, related. What we call the irrational, the intuitive, depth, ESP, LSD, this is discontinuous, unconnected, non-uniform, iconic. All dreams your dreams at night, anybody's dreams at night, are iconic. There is no pictorial connection or vanishing point in any dream image. Why? Very simple reason. You're not using your eyes at all. You're using all your senses. Now, why do we dream? What is the function of dreaming? Because it is well known in experiments that if you stop people from dreaming, they go mad. That's, I mean, if you interrupt people's dreams at night, and it's easy to tell when people are dreaming by you simply lift the lid and see whether the eye is moving, and then you wake them up, stop the dream. If you do this night after night, they go out of their minds. Why? What is the function of dreaming? Purification, purging by repetition. You run through the images of the day, you do a newsreel of the day's experience in a cathartic repetition of purgation and purification. And when you're prevented from doing this act of purification by repeat, you go out of your mind. Well, your eyes are closed, and you invent the images you see in your dreams, and it's amazing what the images you can invent. Everybody in dreaming is a pure poet. Incredible imaginative constructions.
Yeah. I would suggest that in dreams, the critical faculty is suspended completely. And the critical faculty is the result of an eye bias, the ability to stand back from a situation and critically analyze it.
Mr. Parker has thus given Coleridge's definition of poetry, a willing suspension of disbelief. In dreams, you believe everything.
Don't we have some information on the dreams of pre-literate people as being distinct?
I haven't heard of any reports on what sort of dreams pre-literates have. But I think when we're dreaming, we're very pre-literate.
I'm going to suggest something. It's possible, I don't know this, but I'm going to suggest that if we live in a world of intense visual bias, the dream is probably compensatory and will feed in the other senses to make that a complete experience. And I'm going to suggest then that if you have primitives living in a largely tactile, oral, kinetic society, it may be possible that their dreams are more highly visual to compensate. I don't know.
I think we better switch on to Caravaggio.
Yeah.
In view of the time.
Yeah.
Just to contrast with this.
This is the vision of St. Paul, in which he is so startled he falls off his horse. That's the story. And incidentally, a painting of this period, this is Caravaggio, 15th century. He was the first painter to really explore the whole business of...
show business. He was pure show business.
Of course. He has an interesting story about Caravaggio, just in passing, that he used to get commissions from various churches to paint murals or paint paintings, and he would do them, and almost automatically the church turned them down because he had a nasty little habit of going out in the streets and picking up a girl off the streets and painting her as the Virgin Mary, for example, or whatever. So the church resented this. But however, all Caravaggio's paintings went into the private collections of cardinals.
Good business. They paid big money. But He painted startling images, and notice his use of light and shade. This is to create sensationalism. Sensationalism simply means appealing to some one sense at the expense of the other senses.
Foreshortening is a tremendous part of this, too. Of course, look, the man lying on the ground... the whole body is approximately two heads high in visual terms, that the size of the head is approximately equal to the size of the torso. This is intense foreshortening and was, of course, the mode which was developing, which is totally and completely visual, because your experience of a figure through the other senses is constant size relationship of the head to the torso.
This would be the road to Damascus when Paul had his vision. The idea of, you see, medieval painting had no show business in it at all. It was icon. But here you're moving into the world of the movie.
That's right.
Light and shade. High moment of drama. The clincher, the close-up.
And the use of chiaroscuro, actually, not just for the modeling of forms, but for its dramatic impact. I think you can see it here, actually, that the lights are so disposed as to create a tremendously intense dramatic instant.
I have a poem of Herbert, 17th century, about the same time as this, which I'll just partly read. The English were always later. As Chesterton said, when the world's going to hell, the poor are nearest to heaven because they're at the end of the procession. There's a great advantage in being in a backward country in a time like this. But Herbert, George Herbert, religious poet of the 17th century, has a famous poem called The Collar, meaning the constraining, he's harnessed. And he's hemmed in. And he begins the poem, "I struck the board and cried, no more. I will abroad. What? Shall I ever sigh and pine? My lines in life are free, free as the road, loose as the wind, large as store. Shall I be still in suit? Have I no harvest but a thorn to let me blood and not restore what I have lost with cordial fruit?" Well, the whole poem goes that way, and he roars and shouts from beginning to end, "Forsake thy cage, thy rope of sands, which petty thoughts have made, and made to thee good cable to enforce and draw and be thy law. While thou didst wink and wouldst not see, away, take heed, I will abroad. Call in thy death's head there." But as I raved and grew more fierce and wild at every word, methought I heard one calling, "Child." And I replied, "My lord." That's pure sensationalism. But the idea of bursting out, this is the Renaissance idea, Columbus, explore, get out of here, let's get cracking, let's move. And then suddenly, still small voice.
This is two moods, isn't it? Juxtaposed two moods. In the poem, it suggests the juxtaposition of two disparate modes. But in the painting, I'd like to point out a very interesting thing that happens with chiaroscuro. That is the use of modeling from light to dark. Then in such a painting, you have two points of view. If you have a head, for example, and you light it from one side, the shadow line where the light ceases will constitute the profile if you had been in the position of the light. So he draws the profile from one position as the light defines it, and he draws it from his own position as his eye defines it. So you have these two modes, the Dun, "Whoever comes to shroud me." You know that poem?
Yeah, the famous Dun poem, which begins, "Whoever comes to shroud me, do not harm or question much that subtle wreath of hair above mine arm. It is a sign, the outer form you must not touch." It's a little love knot from the Sweetie Pie. And to put it in this profound religious context gives you two points of view which are ludicrously incongruous.
Also dead and alive simultaneously.
He sees himself as a corpse being embalmed. But all he's interested in is that little love token on his wrist from his girlfriend. This creates a kind of sensational illumination of a spiritual condition.
Reminds me of two friends who meet each other, and one says, "You're looking fine. Who's your embalmer?"
But, the discovery, the Renaissance discovery that you could use two points of view to get sensationalism, it's schizoid, split personality. And the split personality comes into Western world with printing and visual space, which splits off from the other senses.
His medical opinion review on the idea of this schizophrenia coming from print orientation. Clinically, the schizophrenic is not visually oriented. A schizophrenic won't read. He'll only read when he's convalescing. They usually just sit around and listen to auditory.
I haven't seen this article, but I'd like to. It sounds very amusing. That a schizoid will only read when he's convalescing suggests a very bad conscience indeed about the printed word.
I have something to say about that, actually. In an article called Psychiatry and the Written Word, he points out that the African schizophrenic moves immediately to action. He'll cut off your head or knife you. Whereas his European counterpart goes into privacy. Into hallucination, private hallucination, no action. And I think the reason for this is that to the African, there is no possibility of separating himself from his tribe, even in madness. He is part of a corporate life. That's somewhat allied to what you're saying.
I haven't read that article for a long time. Who's it by again? Do you remember?
I forgot.
It's a fascinating article. Psychiatry and the Written Word. I think it's certainly in the bibliography of the Gutenberg Galaxy. The Gutenberg Galaxy, by the way, is the indispensable introduction to understanding media, and it's never been printed in the United States. It's a historical introduction to the printed, written and printed word, and it's only printed at the University of Toronto, which is, it's in paperback up there, but it really hasn't ever had any American distribution. So I can't ask you to consult it, but the Psychiatry and the Written Word is played up there. It's in our bookstores.
Yeah.
I don't know whether many of you have heard about or read about this Esalen Institute out at Big Sur in California. And they take in all kinds of groups out there for a variety of programs, what they call sensitivity training or sensory awareness. And the largest part of what they do is just to try to make people aware once again that they have a body, that they have senses, and kind of get them to stop being uptight. And, George Leonard is, Marshall is out there, the senior editor of Look, with whom Marshall has done several pieces. And Mike Murphy is the director of it. He's a fellow who's come out of a very strong Oriental Zen background. And it's one of the most interesting places in the country in terms of the way people finally get a new feel for who they are and start not being afraid of relating to one another. If Murphy comes in or Leonard comes in, maybe we can have them talk about it. Have any of you been there by any chance or taken part in anything similar to this?
I did last year. I just had a session.
Does it work?
I've never been in one. I've observed.
I led a session about two weekends ago, and it just heightens awareness, enables people to listen, to pick up how people feel and to trust their own feelings. And if you're honest about yourself, it opens up people quite a bit, turns people on.
The artists are the antennae of the race. They're the ones who pick up the messages that most people don't get. That's a phrase that goes far. Artists are the antennae of the race. They're the point where evolutionary change takes place intellectually and spiritually. But every man is potentially an artist to be turned off. As soon as he stops blocking his awareness. Now, they're the equivalent of the primitive cave artists. That is, they're doing voodoo. They're doing magical manipulation of the corporate life
of the community. That's a little different from what Pound had in mind. Pound was thinking, along with, say, Yeats and Eliot and Joyce and people like that, he was thinking of the all somewhat more elevated modes of awareness, if you like. But the fact of the matter is that in our own corporate society, Madison Avenue represents the cave artists magically trying to compel the outer world to behave in a way consistent with their dreams. They are, in, seems to me, in every sense of the word, artists, but artists whose vision is perhaps a bit clouded. We, you see, the trouble with the word artist in our Western world is it's a classified term. It means uplift. Getting away from whatever you know. Pure escapism. Therefore, I seldom use the word, and I think it has many unfortunate effects when it is used. It shuts you, it blocks your perception. The word art does not help people to understand art. It has the exact reverse effect.
Yeah, we get this in the movie thing a lot, in the efforts to get, you know, good film studied as an integral part of people's education in college and high school. And you get somebody who will go through an enormous experience in front of a film and be moved in many ways stronger than almost any other experience they get. And yet a day later they can get in a conversation and talk about, is movie an art? Because we've got this hang-up from the elite culture about art, you know, being so respectable and comfortably apart and often the suburban areas of anybody's real experience.
I was with a group of artists the other night who denied the fact that photography was an art.
Yeah,
sure.
How would you define an artist, Marshall?
I'd start with what the word means.
Start with what the word means, making. Making sense. The artist takes our sensory experiences and turns them into something really exciting. Most of us don't know how to make sense of our sensory lives. All, as Robert Louis Stevenson once said, I could make a world epic out of a newspaper if I only knew what to leave out. In every moment of our sensory experience, we create wonderful works of art. But it's all clouded because we don't want to know what to leave out. Art is making, not matching. And we make sense all the time. Every moment of our conscious lives is really making. But it's blocked and clouded by so many extraneous factors that we pick up from our culture that... well, for example, any Oriental will tell you, you people in the West spend all your time getting ready to live. The very nature of our, or the organization of our lives and the programming of our lives is getting ready for some great distant event that never takes place in our lifetime. I'm not speaking now of religion. Just from an Oriental point of view, the Western world is a ludicrous scene in which everybody spends all his time and energy getting ready to live. That's like saying, we really are artists. Why spend all your time trying to cultivate art and to buy expensive works of art which you don't understand?
So the stance of the hippie actually is absolutely antithetic to that, because their creed is the nowness of now. Not getting prepared for anything, but the nowness of now.
Getting ready to live is part of our visual programming of connecting everything to everything, having a place for everything, doing everything in an orderly, blueprinted fashion, which has no connection with our inner being or needs, whatever.
I'd like to speak to this business of how do you define an artist. I used myself usually the word creative individual, which seems to me to encompass a great deal, many more fields. In other words, to me, a mathematician can be an artist in the sense of being a highly creative individual. And I was once asked in a meeting to define creativity, and it's a difficult thing to do, but one of the things I said was that One thing which I know is basic to it, and that is the ability to challenge your cultural assumptions.
The artist is always a rebel.
Yes, Picasso said that art was an act of dissent.
He's a rebel because ordinary perception is blocked, cliched, blind, and he insists that we use our perceptions in exactly the opposite way, as alert, alive, sensitive, which is what the Esalen Institute is all about, except that it is an imported oriental mode of doing this, rather than making use of our own Western means of perception.
When art is not an act of dissent, actually, it degenerates down to be to a matter of good taste. And I've long ago said that good taste is the first refuge of the witless.
Good taste is based entirely on classification. Is this the right kind of thing to have in one's home? Is this good art? Is this the right kind of object? Is it suitable to this or that? This is good taste. It's based entirely on non-perception and panic fears about public opinion. A good taste is the exact opposite of perception.
You think that the put-on is perhaps a modern way of challenging the people who just work in the good taste world?
You sort of take them in terms of the way that they would talk about what's going on, and make them very insecure about whether they're just...
Put on in what sense?
The put on in the sense of, I'm putting you on, I'm going to make you feel insecure by feeding you back to yourself so that you're not quite sure whether I'm feeding back the you that I agree with or the you I disagree with or whether I'm caricaturing you.
Well,
But the thing is to play it cool with... leaving lots of stuff out, keep the audience insecure.
The artist puts you on, literally, in the sense that he wears you as his mask. He makes you see yourselves by creating a mask which consists of his audience. That's the only way anybody can be a movie star or be a star of any kind. He has to put on his audience, and then he has to shape that image into a meaningful one. He holds the mirror up to nature. In that sense, he puts you on.
Can we have that slide again, please? The Gandara one, actually.
Just in case, we'll meet in the small groups
the other one.
Tomorrow morning. And after this class, there'll be a meeting of the leaders of those small groups up in Dr. McLuhan's office.
I just want to make one point which I neglected to make, and that is that as the storytelling element develops from the West, as is integrated into the East, what you do is to get a great deal of connection between figures. And it's usually allied to psychological gestures which are related to the storytelling element. Now, this is in direct contradistinction to the idea of the electronic age as building separate units which are unconnected. I personally believe that it is the abrasion between these centers without margins, which is the interval. This is the area of study. This is the area of perception. But I would like to point out that one fact, that you get the connections. Arms move to arms. Hands touch hands. A whole building up, which is totally alien to the icon I showed you yesterday, where each person stands as a unique entity alongside another person with no connection. No, about that.
That's unique. Isolated.
Yeah. Except there's something to do with that sheet there. I mean, there's a second.
The tendency, though, of Oriental art is not to connect anything to anything, but to isolate the form meditatively. And you have these little instances just up on the walls there. The ultimate development of all progress is stasis. Meditation. The day is not far off when anybody who makes an invention will be put in jail for endangering the whole equilibrium of society, opening up Pandora's box again, and so on.
I think that's it. Is that time?
Fine.
Yeah.